minutes, so we're probably going to have to figure out 2.5 minutes that we can strike out. But I think at this point, with the brief presentations that we have had from our two guests, I think perhaps we might ask them now to, in a more informal manner, just tell us a little more about these works and perhaps carry on a form of discussion or dialogue. Kenner Goldberg, would you do us the honors first, please? There must be many experiences that you could share with us about Bloch, and I'm sure we'd all like to hear them.
Well, I was going to share my experiences with you. I'm going to share them right now. That means we're going to play some excerpts, some very short ones, from his various compositions, which do have more or less a special Jewish flavor, understand. Before, because of that very limited time, I don't know who was a criminal to overstep the time.
I followed. Were only four.
Was it me?
You were both about equal.
Equal, okay.
You see, what we did here was we had a few cams and haws and things like that.
All right.
You can't blame the audience. Nobody coughed.
So, I will start out with three very short excerpts from Concerti Grossi, which I was had planned to play before, but due to the short time, we decided not to play it now. But we are going to play it right now. The first are two short movements, or just very short part of those movements, by a Concerto Grosso by Corelli. Now comes the second is a, what did we write down there? This is the second movement.
Prelude.
That was a prelude, yes. And now?
No, that's coming up now.
Okay.
First was the second movement.
About in the same, you have, you know that all classical compositions are sometimes quite repetitious, and you took out the main motif in order not to have it too long. Now we are going to hear what Ernest Bloch in his style does with the Concerto Grosso. But let's find out the difference. They are just about 200 years apart. That's all. Again, I say it continues the same style. We give a little bit more now because many people think that is outspoken Jewish, what's coming now. It's called dirge. Dirge means funeral music. I didn't feel it was that tragic.
Thank you.
could be Puccini, could be Massenet, could be Debussy. You were stingy there. I think the next.
Next is the start. That was the first part of the sacred service. Now we're going to have.
Wait a moment. Yeah. Dance. Now before we start with the real great work, the sacred service. Not the whole. Although, if you like to hear more of it. When the session is over, we'll get the phonograph and we'll play for you the whole thing. Now, first, I'll let Ernest Bloch himself talk, and I quote, "I am a Jew, and I aspire to write Jewish music because it is the only way in which I can produce music of vitality, if I can do such thing at all." Then I'd like to tell you about the one melody which always impresses me most in the sacred service, and that is the Shema Yisrael. Are here non-Jews in the audience? Well, it's Shema Yisrael is a watchword of our religion. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And why does that impress me mostly? Who of you has ever been in a Hasidic synagogue, or in a shul, or in a shtibel, must remember the behavior of the Hasidim when they say, or better, when they dance out, when they hit out our watchword, they close their eyes and they hit the wall with their fists. And this is the way Ernest Bloch must have heard it and experienced it sometimes. Understand? He must have been in such a synagogue. And this is the way he puts it to music. When you hear in a Hasidic shul, or even in a very strictly Orthodox synagogue, the worshippers saying the Shema Yisrael, as I said before, they close their eyes, they put their hands into fists, and they concentrate 100%, and they say, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Anybody of you have ever heard that? I think you must have heard that. Now, sometimes it comes out even a little funny, because if 50 men do exactly the same, they are not trained, there's no director, and that last tone doesn't come out together by the 50. It comes out then, Adonai Echad, Adonai Echad. Hut, 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 hut. Understand? But this doesn't take away anything of the reverence and of the dignity of the service. And when you will hear now, we don't start out with that directly, but I am going to give you the cue. When it comes to the Shema Yisrael, to that particular place, I'm going to show it to you. Now, I'll continue before we start that you have a little guidance throughout it and understand it better. Here is what the famous David Even, the musicologist, has to say about the following Ve'ahavta. That comes right after the Shema Yisrael, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And this is usually chanted and written by composers in a very special style. It's a mixture between the cantillation, the classical and traditional cantillation of the Torah, because you find it in the Torah and Deuteronomy, and a little Chazanut. Chazanut means the style in which Candace usually sings. Now, he writes about the following Vahafta, and a little later the Tzur Yisrael, Kumu Be'ezras Yisrael, which the translation is Rock of Israel, arise to the help of Israel. How actual, how timely, isn't that? Then, about these two, he writes, in this work, the sacred emotion of the race that slumbers far down in our soul has been given eloquent expression. It has visions of unearthly beauty that lay upon the spirit of the listener an angelic serenity which uplifts and ennobles. I'm afraid I'm going to hurt somebody now, some of you. I repeat only what he writes. It so happens that I must agree with that. On the other hand, an honest critic cannot accept passages as, for instance, the Yimloch chorus. Yimloch, which means at the end of a sanctification, the Lord will reign forever and ever. Also in the evening service, or also in the morning service, at the end of Who's Like Unto Thee, the Lord will reign forever and ever. It is bombast and pomp. It is. You will hear it for the most part. Yet, though lamenting these facts, the sacred service remains a work of most outstanding importance. Now, as for my opinion, I want you to believe me that it is far from me to pour any derogatory water into the wine of family pride of Ernest Bloch. But the truth is, this sacred service, the most of it, in most of its parts, has caused, right after its first performance in 1933, controversy, and continues to cause, especially for those who know something or much of our prayers and the tradition of our synagogue music. And therefore, the sacred service, though it is great music, should not be held as truly Jewish music. I mean, all the way through. So I showed just a few examples which are truly old tradition music, taken almost 100% original from tradition. Let us assume, though it's based largely on text from the Old Testament, it is intended to be seen as the expression of an act of universal worship and of Bloch's intense sense of human brotherhood. And now let's hear the beginning of the sacred service. Let's assume that this is the prelude by an organist when you enter the synagogue. You are supposed to be brought into the right mood by an organist in our modern synagogues. The strictly Orthodox, the old traditional Jew, doesn't need that. When he comes to shul, he brings it along. No discrimination against reform. How beautiful are thy tents, O Jacob! I choose first the English text that everybody can understand. You hear the
disturbs you when I explain about it. It's traditional that the teacher comes into the synagogue before he hears that I came to inquire. He says himself, Van libero prestaha obovisem. And through thy loving kindness, I am privileged to enter this house of worship. Lord, I love
as in our temple. Lord, it seems I am very pleased by your patience, and I foresaw that. And for that reason, I don't want to hide from you the Hebrew version of that, exactly the same. Now, what you just heard was by a baritone, Rosemiller, and it was done by the London recording and directed by Ernest Bloch himself. You will hear the difference. I don't try to influence you. I leave it to you. You will hear the difference right away when you hear now the Hebrew version directed by Leonard Bernstein and the cantor's part by Robert Merrill.
That's still the London.
Yes, traditional style for this particular prayer through Israel. Everybody knows it. He didn't dare to change that. Now comes Robert Merrill.
Thank you. teach them to thy children, should speak of them. My burden is, you should teach it to your children that you could talk about it with them. Once a teacher, you know, like unto thee. The Lord will reign. Should we continue? Because now comes the relaxation. Now comes the real Jewish music by Ernest Bloch. That's the Shlomo and the Baal Shem suite. You want to hear it, or you want to have it interrupted by something else?
Well, why don't we go on with, you know, with Mr. Henninger as part of the program, and then that we can do very informally afterwards.
Okay, I accept
while we get some refreshments.
Mr. Henninger, you're on again. Okay, come on. I have some questions written down here, but I'm really going to kind of ignore them because they really don't ask very much. So I'll just turn it over to you, and why don't you give us a little more about either one or both of the two works?
I hate to see you leave because
right,
we
stay.
Talked before the concert. Mrs. Okay. Myers has some interesting observations herself about these music. Rather than this music, rather than go any more into a lecture, I do this all week. I would much rather have questions from you about either work. Perhaps I can help enlighten them. Yes, sir.
I was really enjoying very much what you were saying about Houston, and I appreciate it if you just go on. I don't know very much about the structure of it.
Usually, symphonic poems are very free and somewhat go on the whim of the composer, as this does. I'm not so sure that I can be of much help. I don't know that Strauss was much help to us. The very beginning of this particular work affects me very deeply. I think it was beautifully done. But then it, in my opinion, deteriorates rather quickly. And some of the things that are in this rather long middle passage, I wonder if it couldn't have been done a different way. I'm sure Strauss would feel that way today as well. But the beginning, I think, is excellent in every way. It's almost startling. I'm sure if you go with the open approach, it will make your hair stand on end. The wonderful beginning. Some of the dissonances that Strauss uses in this work are rather old hat to us today. But in Strauss's time, this caused great discussions. They were wondering if he was completely off his rocker, if he'd completely gone mad, but this has been the history all through music. If you go to a concert now and they play something as early 20th century as Alban Berg, you may be a little startled by it. He's rather old hat now. We don't need an orchestra anymore. We do things electronically. And that's rather startling. So it does stimulate discussion as Strauss's work did in those particular times. Yes, sir.
Would you listen to Strauss with a picture, expecting a picture of what the title tells you, or would you just listen like pure music?
He started this way. But yet he wrote that you should listen just the opposite way. If it does conjure up a picture in your mind, that's fine.
How about that in Transfiguration?
I think the same would hold true in all of his music, even Till Eulenspiegel, that does have a definite program. You could throw the program out and still enjoy the music. I certainly do. So it's kind of up to you. I think listening to music is very personal. If you want to go into it very deeply, then facilities are available, and excellent facilities right here in San Diego in the downtown library and the excellent collection Mr. Wolf has and his direction in that. If you want to listen to it on a purely sensuous plane, just how it affects you at that moment, that's certainly a good way. I wonder if all of us don't somewhat do that, including composers. Yes.
How can an amateur that hasn't studied music, how can he figure all these things out?
I don't think I would be too concerned about figuring them out. I'd let the program notes will be of some help. Mr. Wolf is still writing them, I believe he is. This would give you a guide to listen, and if you really get fascinated by a work, then this takes a lot of time to develop. When I was called about doing this, I said, yes, I'll accept and forgive me, but these were my words, because it's such an absurd idea in 15 minutes to try and tell somebody about Schubert's Fourth Symphony or the Zarathustra. This is years of work for someone in music just to get a little bit close. I'm still struggling with Till Eulenspiegel myself, trying to discover all the marvels that Strauss has in this one little tone poem. So perhaps that's an answer to your question. There is no answer. Anything else that I may be able to help you with? I much prefer this. I'm much more fascinated by Schumann, which is strange for a 20th century composer, I know. But there's a certain honesty, I think, in Schumann that may be somewhat lacking in Strauss. There's a lot of padding that goes on there, and Schumann was too honest of a person to do that. He was so honest that he lived about half the age that Strauss did. That gets an honest person down, I guess, living. Any other questions may have come to mind? Do you have any, Mrs. Myers?
Well, I know before we began, we were batting a few ideas about it, and you were saying that you felt that Strauss was, to some great extent, riding a very popular philosophical wave at the time and trying to cash in on it, as it were. What was there in Nietzsche that found Strauss?
The argument. People were very confused about his writings, and this was the subject of conversation. I don't know what I might list today in that same vein. I don't know that we can. Maybe existentialism is a type that might cause discussion today. But Strauss was wide open for ideas that he could cash in on. And who blames him? Stravinsky, one of our great 20th century composers, certainly isn't above that. When he was approached by George Gershwin, and this is an old story, but a true one, Gershwin wanted to study with him, and Stravinsky said, before we go any farther, he said, how much do you earn a year? How much are you worth? And George Gershwin said, well, I guess this year it would be about $250,000. Stravinsky said, I should be studying with you. So don't blame poor old Richard Strauss for feeling that way. We all do. We all get very tired of writing music for the shelf. Symphonies are interested in playing premiere performances, but I don't know of any symphony that's looking for a second or third performance. All of my things have been premiered by the San Diego Symphony. They've never asked for another performance, which is unfortunate. There was a group of composers a few years back that was dedicated only to second performances. They wouldn't perform any premieres. You have to somehow pay the bills, and we have various ways of doing that. Many composers nowadays teach, not because they find that a last resort, but they find that they can do this with some success. I don't think anyone should teach because they have to. I think there should be a certain amount of love of working with people. Yes, sir.
Should anybody be ashamed, any person be ashamed if he doesn't like modern music?
Not at all. Give it a chance.
Give it a chance?
By all means.
What do you think of Copeland, Air Copeland?
I have a very, yes.
What do you think of his music?
I have a very high opinion of Aaron Copeland.
Did you hear him last night on
yes,
Channel 15?
I did watch.
Couldn't listen to him. He was so discordant to me. And so did him.
Well, it's unfortunate because this is rather old hat stuff that he did. Yes. It takes, yes. I teach a class in contemporary music, and it takes me about 18 weeks, but I bring them kicking and screaming into the 20th century, and by the end of the semester, they're at least willing to look at it. It takes some time. It takes some enthusiasm on your part to try and understand that they're sincere. As the art is, this isn't particularly easy to come by.
In other words, keep on listening to it and gradually.
Music is more difficult because it passes by. Art you have and can keep reflecting on it. You should do the same with music. It's worth the effort.
I'll really try.
Yes.
What do you think about Weber?
The few things that he wrote that I feel that I know somewhat, I'm sure that he was an absolute genius.
Weber.
Weber. Yes, Anton Webern.
That bell, yes. How do you call it?
By all means. I'm sure we're with the same composer. Webern is a composer that has gleaned just the bare essentials. Everything else is left out. There's no pattern.
Is there music in it?
And music
is there music in it?
Very different.
Thank you.
It's exceedingly, yes. Well, I wonder how hard you have tried.
I've tried twice.
Well, if you'd said 100 times, then we might have a response. I wonder how easy you can come to a Beethoven quartet in quite honest terms. I still marvel at them. In fact, when I was writing my first string quartet, the professor, and by the way, I studied with a professor who studied with Ernst Bloch for many years, Halsey Stevens, so I got a little of the training secondhand. He said, before you begin the quartet, I'd like you to survey the literature. Take all of the Mozart quartets, all the Beethoven quartets, and maybe even look at some contemporary quartets. And when he got all through with his little speech, he said, there's one big problem. And he scratched his head and he said, when you get all through looking at Beethoven and Mozart, you'll wonder, what is there left to write? And then you begin. And I'm sure Webern went through this trauma as well. But fortunately, he did write. And these are real marvels. They're very sophisticated things. They take an awfully lot of concentration to come by. I recommend it, yes.
You mean appreciating that music? You got to know the technique of it, or the melodies, or that'll stick to you?
I think you have to get used to a different perspective. We see things differently now because we can fly high. Beethoven wasn't able to do this. So you see things in painting that get a different perspective, and you do in music. There's no need to play the first part over and over again as Haydn and Mozart did. Nowadays you could play the A part and most people could whistle the B part and the A part comes back and so on. Anton Webern is a long way from this. You've got a few notes and the rest is up to you as a listener. It's hard to do. It's hard for someone trained in music to do. But I still say it's worth the effort. There's nothing more varied than the 20th century. As Cantor Goldberg pointed out, this is wonderful music, and it is music of the 20th century. Most of you, I'm sure, didn't have any big problems with this, but there was a time when they did have. So everything becomes old hat, yes.
I've heard so much about the electronic music. Do you think that it's here to stay? I haven't heard any, really. So
it's easy. There's an electronic workshop right in La Jolla at the University of California, San Diego. Very easy. Anytime you're interested, it's worth a trip over.
Do you think it has a lot of possibilities then, that it's going to be around?
For a composer, I think so. I mentioned a moment ago that it's easy to get premier performances, but you don't live on them. They're very expensive. When the San Diego Symphony plays one of my works, it can cost me $100 or so to get it ready for them to perform. But with electronic music, there isn't that problem. You are the person in charge, and you make the recording, and you put all the instrumentation on, it's on the tape, and it's performed this way. So there's no intermediary. It's composer to you. No middleman. No extra charge. I wonder if we haven't somewhat been driven to this. Leonard Bernstein feels we have, and the symphony orchestra, you've no doubt read the article, is past history. Who knows?
How can a composer make money on electronic music? Nobody else will play the same thing unless he has.
Well, how many of you would come to a concert of electronic music, just for curiosity's sake?
I'd like to hear it. Just
yes, there are some, and this is how profit can be made. John Cage wrote a piece early in the 20th century, a 10-minute piano sonata with no sound.
I heard that.
It's interesting.
From some of the comments I heard, it seems some people either do not understand certain music or have a particular and definite distaste for it. I do feel that if most of us were had time unlimited and could accommodate in listening to more of all serious music, that you could grow to appreciate all kinds of serious music. In other words, put the question more simply, do you feel there's any such thing as a badly written serious musical piece?
Many. But I don't think they're given a chance really for a good decision. I don't know that it involves a great deal of time. I just think it involves the right kind of concentration and a willingness.
Thank you. Sir John Barbaroli has led the Halle Orchestra performing the Dance of the Hours from La Gioconda by Ponchielli. We conclude our music from across the footlights with the famous aria from Rigoletto, La Donna e Mobile by Verdi, in this orchestral setting featuring the Capitol Symphony Orchestra under Carmen Dragon. Carmen Dragon has led the Capitol Symphony Orchestra in La Donna e Mobile from Giuseppe Verdi's Rigoletto.
You are listening to KSDO FM in San Diego,
the classic station over Southern California.
Music by Serge Prokofiev, a suite of selections from his opera The Love for Three Oranges. William Steinberg will conduct the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra.